This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the connection between oral health and your heart with naturopath Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We'll learn why sleep is the missing link for women's health with psychologist and author Dr. Julie Merriman. We'll discover the challenges of treating sickle cell disease with hematologist Dr. Kevin Kuo. And lastly, we'll find out how to protect yourself from ticks and Lyme disease with health and wellness entrepreneur Kurt Avery. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Researchers at McGill University and Yale School of Medicine have discovered that learning to speak may depend more on the brain's sensory systems than on its movement control areas. For many years, scientists believed that speech learning mainly relied on motor regions of the brain, which control the movements of the mouth, face, and vocal tract. However, the new study suggests that areas responsible for hearing sounds and processing physical sensations are more important for learning and remembering new speech patterns. To test this idea, researchers altered participants' speech in real time and played the modified sounds back through headphones. Participants then adjusted the way they spoke. The team used transcranial magnetic stimulation, aka TMS, a non-invasive brain stimulation technique, to temporarily disrupt activity in different regions of the brain. When the auditory cortex, or somatosensory cortex, was disrupted, participants had more difficulty retaining the speech patterns they had learned 24 hours later. Disrupting the motor cortex had little effect. Researchers say that the findings could change how scientists understand speech learning and may help improve future technologies designed to restore communication abilities after a stroke. The team also hopes that research will lead to new sensory-based treatments for speech recovery and movement disorders. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Colleen Hartwick in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. Dr. Colleen Hartwick is a licensed naturopathic physician who's been in private practice since 2012 in Campbell River, BC. She has a special interest in trauma as it pertains to physical illness, and as such, her practice focuses on mental health. In addition, Dr. Hartwick is passionate about sharing her knowledge and has been a part-time instructor at the Canadian School for Nutrition since 2015. She also publishes educational articles with Naturopathic Currents. Colleen, I have to admit, when we first discussed this topic, I thought, how do you make brushing and flossing interesting? But the more that I've looked into it, the more I realized that this really isn't about our teeth. It's actually about inflammation, immunity, and why your mouth may be telling you more about your health than you realize. What do you think?
I couldn't agree more. Again, seems, I don't know, like a banal topic. And yet this is one of the topics that once you learn about it, you're never going to look at oral hygiene and oral health the same way. So I'm excited.
So, you know, coming from a litigation slash corporate background, you wouldn't think that like I'm a philosophical or spiritual person or think about things like this. But as I get older, it's the fundamental interconnectedness of everything. And if you take the time to notice it, you know, they say your eyes are the windows to your soul, but it may be your mouth.
Yeah, maybe we should change that to your teeth and your gums are the window to your health.
Exactly. So most of us think about oral health. We think about cavities and bad breath and maybe not having dentures and having our teeth fall out. But we're hearing more and more about what's happening in our mouths could affect the rest of our bodies, including our hearts and even in our immune system. Is there any factual grounding behind that?
There is. And the research over the last decade or so is just burgeoning. It's such a misconception, or it's been a misconception in healthcare, that the mouth is somehow separate from the rest of the body. So hopefully through today's conversation, really shed a light on the fact that mouth is not a separate part of the body. It is an integral part of the body, and it's one of the main gateways to it. So every day, the immune system in your mouth is interacting with billions and billions in bacteria. And for the most part, for most of us, those bacteria are completely harmless. And a lot of them are actually beneficial for helping to maintain the integrity of your gums and protecting your enamel from wear and tear. So just like we've had in previous conversations around the microbiome in the intestinal tract, there's actually an oral microbiome. So a living environment of, again, beneficial bacteria, but in some cases, some harmful bacteria. And so like with the intestinal microbiome, the balance of bacteria rather in your mouth is really crucial, and any disruption in that balance can give rise to things like cavities and gum disease.
All right, so let's focus on the gums. You know, they don't just hold your teeth in place. What do the gums do for us?
Yeah, exactly. So again, when I was a kid, really just thought of, yeah, your gums as a structure that just holds your teeth attached to the rest of your skull. But the gums are so much more than that. They're really a living tissue that has a really rich blood supply. And their job, yes, it is to keep your teeth attached to the rest of your skull, but they also help to create this nice tight seal around each tooth. You could almost think of it like a gasket or a really tight turtleneck that creates a barrier that prevents those bacteria in the mouth from accessing other parts of the body. So if your gums start to become inflamed, maybe you notice they're puffy, red, swollen, bleeding, that protective seal is being broken down. And now there is a potential access point for the oral microbiome, the bacteria in your mouth, to actually enter into your circulatory system and potentially trigger inflammation, not just in the mouth, but in other parts of the body.
Okay, so let's talk about the mechanism for that. How can unhealthy gums translate into affecting, you know, your immune system or your heart?
Yeah, so it really comes down to the balance between, again, those mouth bacteria as well as inflammation as a process. So when your gums become inflamed, and this can be one of those like chicken and the egg phenomenon, where if there is imbalance or more pathogenic bacteria in the mouth, that can create inflammation that then damages the gums. And once those gums become inflamed, now the gums and their surrounding dental structures are more susceptible to ongoing damage from, again, bacteria and from inflammation. Again, when gums are inflamed, as we could see with gingivitis or the more severe periodontitis, the immune system is being activated and responding with inflammation. So at the same time, bacteria and the inflammatory compounds the immune system is created, they're now no longer going to just stay in your mouth. They can actually enter into the circulatory system and, as I mentioned, stimulate inflammation in other parts of the body, including the heart, hence the connection between things like gingivitis and heart disease. Again, over the last 10 years or so, as information and research has been really burgeoning in this area, again, researchers have seen a connection not just between oral health, gingivitis, and heart disease. There's also connections with diabetes, fatty liver disease. Even dementia has been associated with poor oral health and conditions like gingivitis.
Yeah, like, so for me, it's kind of like the canary in the coal mine. If my gums start getting sore, or if they start to bleed when I'm flossing or brushing, usually means a few days later, I'm going to catch something like a cold or a flu. Is that just a coincidence or am I on to something?
You might be on to something, but again, depends on what's going on as well. So just something important to delineate that, again, inflamed, red, swollen, bleeding gums, we would call that gingivitis. And while it may be connected to experiencing cold symptoms, the cold is probably not the primary cause, because again, the common cold is caused by one of many different strains of viruses. What can be happening though is that, again, if you've got underlying gingivitis, so gum inflammation, means your immune system is always sort of low grade activated, creating inflammatory mediators that, again, showing up as that swollen red bleeding gums. If you add in then things like poor sleep, stress, and maybe the early stages of a viral infection, the type of virus that might cause a cold, then all of a sudden that low-grade inflammation, the volume can get turned up. You could start to experience more obvious manifestations of the gingivitis. So sometimes for some people, the sore bleeding gums can be an early sign that the body is already under stress, the immune system is already working harder than usual, and then you introduce a virus into the picture, and all of a sudden the symptoms become more pronounced. So maybe more correlation than causation there.
So if somebody experiences bleeding when they're brushing or flossing, is that something they should be concerned about?
Yeah, I think so. Because again, if there's bleeding, it's a sign that the gums are inflamed. And then the deeper question would be, why is that the case? What's contributing to that gingival tissue becoming vulnerable, friable, and bleeding?
So let's move to the teeth. Okay. We hear about straight teeth for cosmetic reasons, but can things like misaligned teeth or crooked teeth or clenching or grinding affect gum health as well?
Absolutely. So if you have crooked or crowded teeth where there's really tight spaces between adjacent teeth, it makes it a lot harder to appropriately clean those teeth, right? Hard for the bristles of your toothbrush to get in there. So it's more likely that bacteria and the biofilms that they create, which we would call tartar or plaque, to accumulate. If bacteria are able to accumulate in those crowded spaces, they can create inflammatory mediators that then over time can give rise to gum disease, to gingivitis. Clenching and grinding might be a little bit different. So they don't seem to directly cause gum disease in the way that plaque and bacteria do. But what they can do is put stress on the teeth and the supportive structures like the ligaments and surrounding gum tissue, where that extra stress can create some inflammation that can then show up as things like receding gums, tooth sensitivity, and some low-grade inflammation, which over time, again, could contribute to some wear and tear on existing gum problems.
Right.
So alignment mechanics really do matter as a part of sort of holistic oral and whole body health.
So with clenching and grinding, it can impact your sleep as well.
Yes. And I see that very often with patients biting through their bite plates,
yep,
waking up with headaches, those kind of things.
I actually have a plate that I use. And in part, it was, you know, the grinding was disrupting my sleep. It was grinding away at the enamel on my teeth. And also, I have receding gums and it wasn't helping. So all those things impact your health. So, you know, if you're having trouble sleeping, you might want to go to your dentist and see what's going on with your teeth grinding and get a bite plate because it might make a difference.
Absolutely. Great recommendation there.
So we talked a bit about bacteria. I always consider the bacteria in the mouth the enemy, you know, like definitely feeding bad breath, et cetera. But is that true?
Not completely. As I mentioned before, like in the intestines, we've got an oral microbiome, so an array of millions of different bacteria that reside in your mouth. A lot of those bacteria are actually really beneficial bacteria, right? They help to maintain the health and the integrity of the teeth and the gums. But in some instances, people can grow more pathogenic or disease-causing bacteria that could wear away the enamel or trigger inflammation that then shows up as things like receding gums or gingivitis. Right, so it's not about viewing mouth bacteria as the enemy, but really exploring what is it that we're doing or not doing as it relates to oral hygiene and diet that's maybe giving rise to the overgrowth of disease-causing or pro-inflammatory bacteria.
So there's a product out there that a lot of people use, but they may not understand what it does to the microbiome in your mouth, and that is mouthwash. So what are your thoughts on mouthwash?
I think that they have their time in place, but a lot of the conventional antiseptic mouthwashes are more suitable for short-term use, say for specific conditions. Maybe you just had a dental procedure done and we want to reduce the likelihood of ending up with, again, mouth bacteria ending up in your circulatory system, giving rise to a significant infection. But a lot of those antiseptic mouthwashes, they don't just destroy the pathogenic or disease-causing bacteria. They can also negatively impact the beneficial good mouth bacteria. So for everyday use, I'm not a strong proponent of traditional antiseptic mouthwashes. There are other strategies that I'm sure we'll chat about that might be more appropriate for long-term use.
Okay, we've talked about what not to do. What should people do? What is a good daily routine? And I appreciate you're not a dentist, so.
Thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. Yep, not a dentist, but know a little bit about this area. Really, it goes back to the basics that probably a lot of us, especially if you are doing your regular maintenance with your dentist, should already be doing. So brushing your teeth thoroughly at least twice a day, using a soft bristle toothbrush and gentle mechanics so that you don't cause unnecessary friction that could irritate, inflame the gums, or contribute to receding gums. Cleaning between your teeth using something like dental floss or interdental brush, or like my mom likes to use a water pick, because especially if you have dental malocclusion, those tightly crowded teeth, it's going to be hard for those toothbrush bristles to get in there. So using some floss or a water floss would be a good strategy to clean in between the teeth. Other things like staying well hydrated are really important for oral health, and that's because the saliva that we produce has antimicrobial proteins in it, so we want to help to maintain a moist mouth to help maintain the balance of the oral bacteria. And as we've mentioned, as you've already mentioned in this conversation, again, these habits aren't just for maintaining healthy teeth and gums. It's really about whole body health by engaging in sound oral hygiene practices.
So what role does diet play in the health of our mouths?
Diet is huge. And I remember back, it was maybe 10 years ago, I was driving to my a lecture that I was teaching down in Nanaimo. And it was the first time on the radio that I actually heard an ad from, I think it was the Canadian Dental Association, recommending people avoid sugary beverages.
Yep.
And that's because those pathogenic or disease-causing bacteria, they love to feed on sugar and refined carbohydrates. So limiting refined sugar can be really crucial for helping to maintain a healthy mouth microbiome. So that's kind of the avoidance side of things, limiting refined sugars, super sweet things, especially sweet beverages. And if you are going to have something sweet, try to do it for a limited period of time. The more exposure your mouth and your mouth bacteria have to sugar, the more likely we are to overgrow bad disease-causing bacteria that produce inflammatory mediators and these acidic byproducts that can damage both the teeth and the gums. Things you'll want to incorporate more in your diet, more fruits and vegetables, especially veggies that contain nitrates. So nitrates, which are in like leafy green vegetables, like spinach, arugula, beet greens. When your mouth bacteria gets exposed to nitrates, they convert nitrates into nitric oxide, which one helps with the health of the blood vessels in your mouth. But nitric oxide also has some antimicrobial properties, so it helps to maintain the balance of good and bad bacteria. Other things in the diet to incorporate more are healthy fats like the omega-3 fatty acids from fatty fish to chia seeds to flax seeds, because they have an anti-inflammatory effect, can help to prevent things like gingivitis.
Time for one last quick question, and that is supplements. Are there any that can help support good oral health?
Yeah, there's some growing evidence about some key supplements for oral health. The first one being vitamin C, really important antioxidant vitamin. So oxidative stress can break down the collagen, which is the essentially structural scaffolding of gums. So for healthy gums, we need healthy collagen, and to have healthy collagen, need sufficient vitamin C. And as I just mentioned on the food front, maybe you don't eat a lot of fish or algae as food sources of omega-3. So you might want to give some consideration then to a fish oil supplement or an omega-3 supplement to, again, help get the balance of inflammation under control. And the last one on the supplement front is coenzyme Q10. There's some decent evidence about it helping with gum health, in part because CoQ10 helps with energy production, and to help build and maintain gums takes a lot of energy. Plus, CoQ10 has some antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties, which really help to protect that gum tissue from the harms of inflammation, oxidative stress. And then some new research is surrounding the use of oral probiotics, as we might use probiotics for gut-related issues. Could look at oral probiotics either as like a mouthwash, or you can get probiotic gums or probiotic tablets to, again, help to introduce more of the beneficial anti-inflammatory bacteria in the mouth.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It was an absolute pleasure. I love this conversation.
That was Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the connection between sleep and women's health on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our longstanding sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Dr. Julie Merriman is a PhD professor and a counselor who aids high-achieving women over 50 in reigniting their spark. As the founder of Soul Joy brand, she serves as a premier authority on nervous system regulation to heal burnout and rekindle intimacy. As the author of the publication, Are We Gonna Have Sex or What?, which is out in April of this year, Dr. Merriman is committed to helping women feel sexy, powerful, in and after midlife. And for more information about her, you can visit www.juliemerrimanphd.com. Welcome back to the show, Julie. How are you doing?
I am great. It's great to be back. Thank you.
Did you get a good night's sleep last night?
I did, actually. I like a baby. I slept great.
So you slept like a baby? You were up like five times and crying all the time? Or
well, you know, when I said that, I thought, well, my kids didn't sleep just wonderful. But no, I slept sound and snuggled with my husband and had a great night.
Excellent. So we're going to talk about why sleep is so important to women's health over 50. So why is that? Like, why does it become an issue in perimenopause or menopause?
Perimenopause and menopause are really already disrupting the sleep architecture for women through night sweats and hormonal shifts and just changes in sleep cycles. And then you layer on top of that decades, perhaps, of overfunctioning, emotional labor, chronic stress, perhaps, and you have a nervous system. Dude, it's been in high alert for years. And the body doesn't suddenly relax at 50. It doubles down on the problem. And really, sleep becomes the casualty in all of this.
So what we're really talking about today is the connection between sleep and rest and how to deal with chronic stress. But your focus is also on sexual health as well. So how does that all sort of culminate? What's the connection between the stress hormones and desire?
Well, interestingly, cortisol and our sex hormones share the same precursor. So if we are in a state, an allostatic load, if you will, of years of stress, because my gals in their 50s, it didn't just start today. It probably started in their 20s sometime. And they've been in this pressure cooker for a good 20, 30 years. Their allostatic load is large. And when they go to try to rest, because rest is really important, during sleep, our sex hormones reset, we process emotional loads we may be carrying. But if we're in chronic stress, instead of resetting, because cortisol and, as I said, our sex hormones share the same precursor. And when we're in chronic stress, cortisol wins over that reset. So it really robs a woman of desire and her libido. Now, it's not gone. It's just buried under years of being in this stress state and not being relaxed. Your body really needs to be safe for desire and rest to even come on board. And when we are, you know, worried about, are we going to get the kids to practice on time? Oh my God, I've got that horrible work meeting tomorrow. Good Lord, it's 4th of July. I've got to cook the picnic. I mean, you know, all these, which seem like just, you know, day to day, our nervous system does not, it's a very primitive system. It doesn't recognize all these life duties, these pressures we put on ourselves as just day to day. They perceive it as that ever, you know, the proverbial saber-toothed tiger or dinosaur chasing you.
Right.
And you don't, that stress cycle doesn't come to a completion. So she's not able to really rest and reset those hormones and really reset her body at night because she's in a chronic state of low-grade threat, if you will.
I guess the issue is it impacts women differently because their hormonal cycle is so different from men's, right? Like, because women are on a monthly cycle and men are almost more like a daily cycle, the impact of chronic stress becomes more cumulative, right? Isn't that what's happening?
I mean, I don't have the hard data to say this study says that, but I do have studies on women specific that show how impacted they are by that time of life. And you know, you're absolutely right. Men and women both have their hormonal fluctuations and go through a certain hormonal change in midlife. It might be more pronounced in women because we perhaps have a higher dose of estrogen that's not only running our reproductive system, but it's also running our brain. And you know, in midlife, all the things we tolerated for so long, she's going, no way, man, not doing this anymore. And she's kind of doing her whole reshift in life. And part of that really does, because it impacts how she's able to rest. It impacts how she's able to let go of things and just allow sleep to come on board, because she's not just worried about her body. She's worried about, you know, she's taking care of her husband. She's taking care of the kids. She's trying to get her job done. And just, we have a lot of factors that we have built, God, these neural pathways that don't just give in to rest. We've really done this to ourselves a lot of times, but hormones play a very big role in this for women. Yes.
So like I'm listening to you speak and there's almost like, I'm not projecting here, but like a frustration or like a resentment sort of at the situation that I'm hearing in your voice. And for some women in menopause, there is this sort of frustration and resentment that can find its way into the bedroom. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think what you're hearing to me, it's just, I feel so sorry. I hurt for him. I remember having gone through it and how frustrating. Yeah, it can be frustrating. Absolutely. Women have often swallowed their truth to keep the peace for whatever reason. And in midlife, we really start feeling that resentment. Now, resentment, society tends to have a you know, like, ooh, we're going to judge that. You shouldn't feel resentment. And I really feel like resentment is a sacred emotion. Oh, it's not an emotion. It's a feeling. It's a state. And if we will just sit with that state and understand what it is that we need, because resentment is really about not getting your needs met. And the only person that doesn't get, that's responsible for that is the gal or the guy in the mirror. I say with love, we are responsible for getting our needs met. We're responsible for working on ourselves. We're responsible for getting our desire back online. A lot of times in my couples sessions I see blame within the couples, and I just, you know, it's, desire is an inside job. First, we have to get it back online for ourselves, and then we work on how it works with our partner. But it starts with resentment. You know, we try to evade it and deny it and have all kinds of guilt about it, but there's nothing wrong with feeling resentment. If we put our hand on that spot in our body where we're feeling it and breathe into it and ask ourselves, what is it we really need? We're going to get some really rich answers that are going to help that stress cycle come to a full stop, you know, that full cycle happen so it can rest. And I tell you, you'll find yourself sleeping better at night. The jaw loosens, your shoulders loosen, you breathe better, you're able to be more fully alive, which is going to help you sleep better.
When we're not getting that rest and we're stressed out, I think it impacts our ability to feel comfortable with ourselves, you know, and part of that is the resentment, and maybe it manifests in different ways. But then it's really hard to manifest attraction for others because we don't feel attractive ourselves, perhaps, right? We're just overwhelmed, we're fatigued, whatever it is, right? That needs to be fixed, right? Doesn't it?
Oh, just so that we can live fully with a quality of life. Absolutely. And one thing I really say to my midlife ladies is that we're not drying up. We're not dead. I'm 63 and I'm here to tell you my sex life, my desire is fabulous, but I had to do work on myself. I had to make sure that I'm showing up fully present. And, you know, make sure I'm not living in a real dysregulated state. I'm a charity university, just took the department through an accreditation visit, which was horrible. And I was so dysregulated. And I know my husband went to touch me. He's so good about it. He sees when I'm dysregulated and he knows that a touch can often help. But I was at a state where I just kind of clenched up and thought, one more thing, you know, yeah. Which that wasn't what it was at all. He was just trying to help me, you know, get back regulated. But what happens, we've lived for so many years in this pressure cooker of dysregulation where we're just so tight that we have forgotten what pleasure even feels like. We've forgotten that we can even feel pleasure because we've put it on this to-do list that just feels like a chore. And if we can feel safe in our bodies again, soften into that pleasure, do the work on ourselves, we're far more open to being receptive and receiving that pleasure with our partner. But we've got to get out of that to-do list mode.
All right. So what do you tell the women that you're working with respect to sleep? Do they have to prioritize the sleep, or is it like a chicken and the egg thing? When they start feeling better about themselves, they'll sleep better.
It's all somatic. This is somatic work. I try to get them embodied. I try to get them to practice before bed, to do a somatic exercise where you squeeze your shoulders up. Everything relaxes. Purposely soften that jaw, 3 deep breaths, bigger on the exhale than the inhale, and practice that every night, feeling your feet on the floor, really trying to be embodied before bed. I'm telling you, if you will get yourself somatically embodied, you're going to arrive to your bedtime so much differently than if you're in that hamster wheel of getting that to-do list. Oh my God, I've got to do this, that, and the other. No, all I have to do is get embodied and relax, soften that jaw before I go to bed. You do that for a week, I promise you're going to feel different in the morning.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today to explain that.
Thank you for having me. Have a great week.
That was Julie Merriman. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the treatment of sickle cell disease. On the Tonic. Feeling tired, low on energy, or simply not getting enough vitamin B12? Discover the difference with Purely Organic Active B12. Made with premium active methylcobalamin, the natural form your body absorbs and uses instantly. Unlike common synthetic B12 supplements, Purely Organic Active B12 contains no colors, flavors, sweeteners, or preservatives. Just clean, organic, vegan support for energy, endurance, and nervous system health. Purely Organic Active B12. Pure energy, naturally made in Canada. You already know the importance of exercise for energy, improved strength, and better mobility. What you really need is an expert to show you how to exercise safely. Receive personalized coaching from Fitness Solutions Plus. Learn safe exercises for osteoporosis, diabetes, chronic pain, and balance issues from a fitness specialist. For a free consultation, visit fitnesssolutionsplus.ca, number one in one-on-one fitness for adults over 50.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Sickle cell disease is a genetic disorder impacting thousands of Canadians. In addition to the daily physical challenges, many patients experience barriers in accessing effective health care. The Scarborough Health Network has emerged as a leader in Ontario in treating and supporting people living with this disease through a comprehensive and personalized approach to supporting adult and child patients. Here to discuss this today is Dr. Kevin Kuo, Scarborough Health Network's VP of Research and Innovation and lead hematologist at the Adult Sickle Cell Disease Clinic, who sees patients across the GTA and beyond living with the disease. Welcome to the show, Dr. Kuo. How are you doing today?
I'm very good, Jamie. Thank you for having me on the show.
So for those who don't know, what is sickle cell disease and who is most affected?
Yeah, so sickle cell disease is a genetic disease that passed down from generation to generation. And the change that happens, the genetic change, is in the protein called hemoglobin. The purpose of hemoglobin is to carry oxygen inside red blood cells around the body. So obviously we need oxygen to live. So it's very important. But when the hemoglobin changes in sickle cell disease, it warps and changes the shape of the red blood cells such that it gets stuck in the blood vessels as they're traveling through the body. And when that happens, obviously the organs are going to be starved of oxygen. And when that happens, it causes damages to all sorts of different organs in the body. Primarily, when we see people with sickle cell, they get pain. It's what we call pain crises. This sort of pain is unbelievable. But in addition to the pain, they also have other sort of damages, and it shortens their lifespan. Like a recent study that I've done showed that people with sickle cell disease are dying at age 39.
Oh, gosh. And who is most affected by the disease?
Yeah, it's primarily people from African origin, but also people from Middle East, South Asia, as well as Southern Europe.
Is it tied to blood type, or is it, or like, why are those areas more prevalent?
Jamie, that's a great question. No, it's not tied to blood type. It's a very common question. But what it's tied to is a historic incidence of malaria. So malaria had a huge influence on human evolution. It exerted what we call a selection pressure. So meaning that people who are susceptible to malaria, they die off easily and they can't have kids. But what happens is if you have the sickle cell trait, not the full disease, but just the trait, it gives the ability for the body to resist the malaria. So obviously people who are able to resist with this sickle cell trait are able to pass on the genes, right, to have the kids.
Right.
And so this sort of selection pressure has literally altered the landscape of human evolution. And this is why sickle cell disease is prevalent in those areas that we just talked about.
Well, that's interesting. So it's an evolutionary issue. I recall growing up, the disease, I'm assuming we're talking about the same disease. I remember it being referred to as sickle cell anemia. Is it still called that? Or is there a reason we're calling it sickle cell disease? Is it the same thing?
I think you brought up a very good point. And while we still use the term sickle cell anemia, the reason why we use sickle cell disease, because there's increased recognition that it's not just one subtype, which is usually what we call SS. Homozygous SS that's being affected. There's other types of sickle cell disease as well that don't necessarily being anemic, but are still suffering from the horrible effects of the disease.
How do those with sickle cell disease manage their condition?
Yeah, it's a very unpredictable life, in fact, because around 4 to 6 months after being born, our patients would start having pain. And these pains are completely unpredictable. It can happen overnight. It can happen during the day. It can happen during an exam or a test or maybe in a very stressful situation at work. Triggers are usually because of infection, because of stress, whether it be emotional or physical. And so it becomes increasingly difficult for people to cope. In addition, as I mentioned previously, because it damages the different organs from the brain to the eyes, to the lungs, to the kidneys, liver, etc., our patients would have other problems with their organs later on in life. And so they need constant monitoring. They need treatment for any damages to the organs. And we also try to provide them with medications that can, in some ways, to try to prevent disease, but it doesn't completely take away all the pain and all the damages.
Do you watch the show The Pit?
No, I don't.
There was a depiction of somebody who suffered from sickle cell disease on the show, and I was going to ask you whether or not that was an accurate depiction.
Well, actually, my wife watched it, and she's a nurse practitioner, and she said it was right on the dot, very accurate.
How does the disease impact children and adolescents?
Great question. As I mentioned previously, the disease starts to exert itself around 6 months of age. And see, here's the thing, right? Blood flows 24/7.
Yep.
It's not like it's the weekend and then they take a break.
Right.
They never take a break. And because they don't take a break, the damages is ongoing. And so throughout the childhood and adolescence, as the person grows, the disease starts to take its toll on the brain, on the heart, on the lungs, you know, the kidneys, etc. And we need to also remember that as a person is growing up, that we're faced with different challenges, right? I mean, as kids, you know, we just go to school, but, you know, as we transition from high school to, you know, beyond high school, we're talking about adolescents to young adults. We're going through multitudes of transition. We may be going to colleges, universities, or maybe we're finding a new job, a first job, falling in love, getting married, right? Moving out. And these can place a lot of stress on our patients. And so while they have to cope with life, they also have to cope with the disease as well. And often it can be a real challenge to navigate through that sort of late teen, early adulthood period. And that's usually the time when most patients get into trouble.
What are some of the barriers that people that suffer with the disease face in dealing with it through the health system?
Wow. It's quite layered, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that there's obviously socioeconomic issues, meaning that many patients who have sickle cell disease generally are from areas in the world where, you know, there's not a good healthcare system to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they come here, they're already quite burdened with all the complications from sickle cell disease. In addition to that, there's a stigma traditionally with people with sickle cell disease that they're either too complex to be managed or that they're drug seeking if they go to the hospital asking for pain relief for their pain crises. Also, because just being, you know, first generation immigrants or second generation immigrants, they often lived in areas where there is very little primary health care, like areas like Scarborough or Etobicoke. And of course, without primary health care, you don't necessarily have the preventative measures that you want to take when it comes to sickle cell disease, because without prevention, if you get a complication from sickle cell disease, you can't recover from it. For example, if say your eyes are damaged by the sickle cell disease, it's called retinopathy, and it bleeds, well, that will lead to blindness. We can't reverse the blindness.
Mm.
And so, you know, that barriers to access to care, you know, having to travel to specialized centers, especially, you know, before we opened this clinic in Scarborough, the adult clinic, people have to travel to downtown to get care. And that takes 1.5 hours. And if your job is a living wage where you're earning minimum wage on an hourly basis, you can't afford to take 3 hours a day just to travel, right? Not even counting the actual visit itself back and forth to see your specialist.
So how did the Scarborough Health Network address these barriers?
Great question. So we, for a very long time, more than 2 decades, we've had a pediatric clinic, which is partnership with Hospital for Sick Children. And up to that point, we were able to manage our patients with sickle cell disease all the way up to age 18 pretty well. But what we found deficient was, as I mentioned previously, that there was no medical home for our patients above the age 18. So in 2025, we created a brand new clinic, a comprehensive care clinic. And what comprehensive care means is that we have nurse practitioners, nurses, physician assistants that work as a team to help the patients. It's not just having the doctor. In fact, I would say of all the team members, I'm the one who is least useful. Because I see my patients on an episodic basis,
Right.
whereas my nurses and nurse practitioners and nurse practitioners, they see my patients, they get in touch with them on an almost continuous basis. So they have that continuity of care is what we call it. In addition to that, in 2023, Ontario Health launched the Sickle Cell Disease Caring for People for All Ages, which is a provincial standard for sickle cell disease patient care. And we engage with patients based on this initiative. We engage with patients, families, to meet these quality standards that were outlined in this guideline while we're incorporating community voices. And then since then, we have improved access to our emergency department such that we're now ranked number one in Ontario for physician initial assessment times for patients presenting with sickle cell disease and pain to the emergency department. We're able to see them within 15 minutes. We have created the adult sickle cell clinic, which allows us to look after patients from 18 to 80. We also have created the partnership with our patients and done education and training to everybody within Discover Health Network and to recognize sickle cell disease, the journey that they're going through, as well as the services that we can provide inside the clinic.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today to explain that.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. Kevin Kuo. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss Lyme disease prevention on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. You already know the importance of exercise for energy, improved strength, and better mobility. What you really need is an expert to show you how to exercise safely. Receive personalized coaching from Fitness Solutions Plus. Learn safe exercises for osteoporosis, diabetes, chronic pain, and balance issues from a fitness specialist. For a free consultation, visit fitnesssolutionsplus.ca, number one in one-on-one fitness for adults over 50.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Kurt Avery is the founder of Sawyer Products, an industry leader in water filtration, insect repellents, sunscreen, and first aid products since 1984. A graduate of Hope College and Northwestern Kellogg School of Management, Kurt has spent decades focused on innovation, humanitarian work, and disease prevention around the world. Under his leadership, Sawyer's water filtration systems have helped provide clean drinking water access across more than 80 countries, supporting communities impacted by waterborne illnesses and natural disasters. Passionate about service and faith-driven leadership, Kurt has helped build partnerships with more than 30 nonprofit organizations dedicated to improving global health and access to safe water. Welcome to the show, Kurt. How are you?
Well, thank you. I'm great. Great to be here. Thank you.
So this is timely for us up in Toronto because we're getting reports of more and more ticks sort of coming up not only in our recreational areas, but in and around where we live. So I thought it would be helpful to bring you in because you have a lot of experience in dealing with this for some key information. Does that sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan.
So what are some of the biggest misconceptions people have about ticks and Lyme disease?
Yeah. First of all, ticks are very slow moving creatures. So they only breathe every 15 minutes. So the first thing we got to do is get the panic out of there. And they take 36 hours to trade fluids with you. So we'll deal with that so we can logically deal with these without the fear factor. They're coming. There's no natural predator for ticks except birds. And so I don't think this is going to go away anytime soon. Lyme disease is not so bad because it can be dealt with doxycycline and antibiotics. Some of the other ones, the alpha-gal and those things, are a little bit tougher to deal with. But what people don't understand is it's the rodents that proliferate the ticks. It's the mice, the chipmunks, the squirrels. That's where the cycle begins. They pick them up in the grass, they take them back to their nest, and that's the cycle where they come. We think about them on the large animals, but it really starts with the rodents. So if you have a lot of rodents in your area, you're going to have a lot of ticks. There are ways to kind of cut that down. You take a little treated cotton ball with permethrin, and they take it back to the nest, and that's going to kill the ticks before they get out into circulation. But what you really want to do is prevent them from embedding. So there was a study just came out from University of Rhode Island that says if you take the permethrin and you treat your shoes and your socks, you're 72 times less likely to have a tick land on you and crawl up there. They're always going to go north, so they're going to start at the in the grass usually, and then they come up. They're looking for the back of the knee, the crotch, the armpit. They end up may end up on the head. But the reason you don't need to panic is when they cross 1 inch of treated fabric, they're done. Now they breathe so slowly, they're going to live for another 4 or 5 hours, but they'll never embed. So you definitely want to get the permethrin. We do all your military and police up there. You can do all your clothes, all that stuff. But remember, they're going to be in the high grass, so keep your lawns down. So you do that, and you're not going to get the tick. That's the most important thing that you want to take care of, is that we don't have the tick land on us. And if we do, it's going to pass away. Then what happens if one does land on you? Remember the key thing: they don't breathe for till every 15 minutes, and they're not going to trade fluids with you for up to 36 hours. So no panic, you got plenty of time. Take a little pair of tweezers, just slowly pull them out. They're hanging on by a little mouthpiece, and the mouthpiece has little tiny barbs in it. So what you don't want to do is encourage them to leave on their own. The people like to use matchsticks or cigarette butts or Vaseline or whatever. If you do that, then they're going to spit everything they have to loosen up those barbs. But they're so slow. You just take some tweezers, go underneath it, very, 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 very slowly pull them out, and then clean up the area, soap and water, maybe alcohol pad or something like that. And now you're looking, if you see a rash or something like that, you can always go to the doctor. It's very easy to take care of most tick bites. Take a picture of the tick if you're concerned about it. Don't bring the tick with you to the doctor. They don't need it. The ticks are very easily identifiable. So take a picture of their back, and we know what we're up against. The other thing is if you think you have them on your clothes, because some of these are small as a poppy seed. What you can do when you come from back from outdoors is you take and you throw your clothes in a dryer and run it hot for about 15 minutes, and that will kill any tick that you couldn't see. So that way you don't have them at home. A big tip for the hunters is when you go ahead and you shoot the large animal, when you put it in the back of the truck, put a treated blanket or canvas down there, and as the animal cools, the ticks drop off. And so they're going to drop off onto the treated fabric, and you're going to bring them all. They're all going to be dead when you bring them home. They live for 4 or 5 hours, but they're worthless. So you do that, and that's the way to, avoid them and also be able to treat it when you come back.
A lot of people think of ticks as sort of like only in like nature, in preserves or in the forest, if you're going hiking or walking or hunting, as you've suggested. But they can exist within our homestead too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Again, the key there is look to see if you have any small rodents. If you have mice or chipmunks or squirrels, they're going to be there. So, you keep your grass mowed short. Try not to wander off into the high grass. But again, that little tip where if you treat a cotton ball with the permethrin and let the mice take that back to their nest, that will kill the tick before it even comes into play. So you look at it, we build our homes into the forest. And so what we've done is we've chased away the natural predators for the rodents. The hawks aren't around, the foxes leave. So because we've chased away the rodent predators, we've got a lot more ticks. And they just don't have any natural enemies. I mean, the birds will eat it, but that's about it. So it's not going to go away. It's unfortunately going to get worse.
So earlier on in our conversation, you were alluding to, pets, dogs, specifically going out in the bush and perhaps picking up ticks. I have a dog, but she takes, we give her this medicine she takes once a month for tick prevention. Are there any concerns if your pet has some form of tick prevention where they could still be picking up the ticks, or is that good enough?
Yeah, the medicine is working through the skin. It's an oil that's proliferating through the skin. So when the tick tries to embed, they're going to come up to the medicine. The other way we do it is we do the dog hair. So we spray the hair, and that's also a barrier. I mean, you can do both, but we do it. Now, you can't spray your cat. Cats can be around it dry, but not wet because they have a different nervous system. When this fabric treatment goes in, it's good through 6 washes and 42 days in the sun. So it's long lasting. It's not just a one-time thing. So yeah, we're very successful treating the dog hair. But you can do both. But this is pretty simple to put it on the hair. The longer the hair, the more effective it'll be.
Got it. So, what would you recommend as a protocol? Let's say I went out hiking and I came back out of the bush. If I'm going to do a tick check, what's the best way to do it?
For if you're going to do a tick check, you obviously are knowing that they're going to climb upwards. You're looking for the back of the knee, obviously the crotch. So you hopefully you got a friend that you can do that with. Armpits and head. You also, it doesn't. Remember now, they're going to take a long time to embed. So a good rigorous shower can knock them out too. So don't be afraid to when you come back to take that shower. Yeah, I just think you got to do the tick check. But again, the biggest thing is to avoid it. Any of that permethrin on the clothes is just going to get rid of them. We do all the military uniforms worldwide. It also, by the way, this permethrin also will chase away the mosquitoes. So you got two for one here. So you're putting on to keep rid of ticks, but you're also chasing away the mosquitoes at the same time. And if you have a lot of bare legs, you can use a topical. We do picaridin, which is a little hard to find where you are, but you can use DEET, any of your DEET sprays. So that's a prophylactic. They're gonna stay away from your leg and arms if you have some DEET on. But then you wash that off when you get home.
You had mentioned that the ticks sort of work their way up, and you mentioned the back of the knee and the armpits and the groin. Is that because those are parts of the body where heat sort of it's damp and it's hotter? Is that why they're looking for those spots?
No, they're looking for very soft skin where they can ease their way. I mean, just think about it. I mean, it takes them, 12, 14 hours to even get that hydrosome into your skin. And you don't even know it. It's not like a mosquito bite where you feel it right away. You won't even know these people are doing it. They're so slow. So they're looking for the softer the skin and preferably dark where you're not going to see it. That's what they're going for, soft skin.
You mentioned Lyme disease, but then you also mentioned another disease I'm not familiar with, Alpha-Gal. Can you explain what that is and what the risks are?
Yeah, that one's a bad one because what happens is you develop an allergy. It's actually your body overreacting to the alpha-gal bite, and it's from the black-legged deer tick. But you get a reaction to it, and you can't eat red meat anymore. That's it. No more red meat for you. So that creates a panic. Whereas Lyme disease, we can deal with it, but alpha-gal, they haven't figured that out yet how to deal with it. So that's another reason to really, really be careful to not get a tick and to get rid of it pretty quickly. Because again, it's going to take 30 some hours before you're going to trade fluids with the tick to pick up alpha gal. But again, it's your body's overreaction. So it's pretty prevalent in New England. So it's coming your way.
Yeah, that sounds unfortunate. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today to explain that.
Okay. Well, thank you for giving us a chance to be here.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Colleen Hartwick, Dr. Julie Merriman, Dr. Kevin Kuo, and Kurt Avery. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, the Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more.
Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you are interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.